up on a tight wire.
I'm Daniel Chacon. Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. Today, my guest is Carlos Aceves, who is a local novelist, activist, nonfiction writer, and a former teacher in the school district here. And we're going to talk about his novel, Diadema. And for poetic license today, we're going to play a couple of poems by a man named Phil Goldvarg. And I'll tell you about this guy later. He was quite a character. He was a Sacramento poet. And even though he was a Jewish man in his 50s, he loved Chicano poetry, and he was a Chicano. So stick around. And talking to Carlos Aceves, it reminded me that my major was political science, and I was going to go to law school. My BA is in political science. And for a few years, Andres Montoya and I, and you know, Andres Montoya is the poet who has a poetry prize named after him, we were leaders of the radical branch of student government. And this was back in the days when student government had a radical branch. And my activism started when I met a Chicana activist at a nightclub. I didn't know she was an activist. I just knew she was hot. I mean, give me a break. I was 21. Anyway, she was standing at the bar, and I stood next to her, ordered a drink, and she looks at me and she says, "Is your drink as good as mine?" "Well, I'm sure it's better," I said. And she reaches over, she picks up my drink, she puts it to her lips as she's looking into my eyes, and she takes a drink and says, "Not bad." So I pick up her drink and do the same thing. Anyway, we hit it off. We hung out with each other all night. And later, after the club was closed, when we were sitting in my car in the parking lot, she wrote down her phone number with lipstick on a paper bag she found on the floor of my car. And our relationship ended up being much more platonic than romantic, but she introduced me to something that changed my life. She was an activist. She was the president of a Chicana collective called Las Adelitas, which, as you know, is the name of women warriors of the Mexican Revolution. She was president of that organization, and they were pretty radical. I mean, they resisted conventional political structures and parties, and they envisioned a future with revolutionary zeal. She was amazing, brilliant, committed. And one day she said to me, "Chacon, you're articulate, and you seem to get along well with people. You should run for student body senator." And they had a party, a radical party, a slate, and they wanted me to be on it. So I said, okay, sure. I was representing the School of Social Sciences, which you can imagine is pretty liberal, and I won the election. So suddenly I was a senator associated with a leftist party, and I mean a leftist party. We thought Democrats were as bourgeois as Republicans. We called ourselves progressives. Anyway, I was a bit naive about politics, but I learned the importance of the Chicano movement to who I am. And I remember Andres Montoya, who was pretty funny. He used to sway his hips back and forth in a sexy move, and he'd say, "Let me tell you about the Chicano movement." But I was an activist before I became a writer. And I discovered I wanted to be a writer the very last semester of my bachelor's degree when I took a creative writing class with Corinne Clegg Hills. And naturally, I brought my activism to my fiction and poetry. Andres also wrote poetry, and he always loved to quote Roque Dalton, the revolutionary Latin American poet. And he said, "The poet is either a clown or the enemy of the ruling class." And that's what we believed. Our writing was our politics. I can see now that the craft of our early work was perhaps as didactic as our workshop instructors said they were. And I remember a poem Andres read to me. We were roommates, and one night he knocked on the door on my bedroom, and he says, "I got to read you this, man. I just wrote a poem. I think it's brilliant." So he stood in front of me, and he was a big guy. And he stands in front of me, and he reads with passion his new poem. It went like this. "Democracy. Democracy? Ha! You call this democracy? This isn't democracy. This is oppression of our gente." I think it was the worst poem ever written. Anyway, Andres and I had great teachers, Philip Levine, Steve Yarborough, Garrett Hongo. So we learned the craft, but being activists remained a fundamental part of who we are as writers. And even though our writing may not be as didactic, it's still very important for us to have a social and political consciousness. And that, I believe, deepens our sense of reality. Carlos Aceves is a writer and an activist, and you're going to love this conversation, so stick around. Carlos Aceves is a local educator, activist, and novelist. We're going to talk today about his new novel, Diadema, which came out with Floricanto Press, certainly one of the most important Latino presses out there. We're very happy to have him on the show. Carlos, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you for having me.
And I have two of your books in front of me right now. One is a novel called Diadema, which came out from Floricanto Press, which really is a fantastic press that does wonderful Latino literature. And this one, which I loved to dip into, it's called Nine Seasons, Beyond 2012, A Manual of Ancient Aztec and Maya Wisdom. Let's first talk about your fiction. Is this the only work of fiction you've ever done?
It's the only work published.
Oh, okay. I know how that is.
Yeah, you know how that is. Yeah, it's my first work that's been published.
Tell us a little bit about the novel.
It has an inspiration and a motivation. My inspiration was from an actual event that happened in 2001 when some friends of mine, a particular friend of mine, had a vision about Waco tanks, that there was a place that we needed to find. And we went looking for it, and after getting lost and searching all over the place, we actually found it, which I thought was a very neat event. And in that particular place, there's what they call now archaeoastronomy. There's an alignment there of a shadow and a figure. And that inspired me to write a novel about, you know, concerning that event. At first, it was going to be a nonfiction, but then I decided to make it fiction because other things got meshed in. The other thing, the motivation came when I found out that the UTEP Museum had several remains that had been taken out of Waco tanks, and they were storing them in the museum. And I thought that was like sacrilege.
Oh, wow.
So that was a motivation. So then
that's why the scene about stealing artifacts from the museum.
Exactly, yes. And the interesting thing about it is that a week after the novel was published, UTEP handed over those remains to the Tiwas for reburial.
Nice.
Which was nice. And I never got in touch with UTEP about it or never made an issue about it. I just started writing a novel around the event. The Adema is a symbol. You know, it's a hairpiece that women wear on their hair. It's kind of a horseshoe hairpiece. But it's more than that. If you research it, it's actually an ancient symbol that's been used by civilizations for, you know, millennia. Mm-hmm. And what it means, it's an illustration of the womb of life because it's that horseshoe shape. Uh-huh. And that's what it means. And so I wanted to write about the sacredness of life and the specialness of life. You know somebody who has that attitude wouldn't have remains stuck in a museum.
Well, you certainly did it in a page turner. I mean, there's a lot of intrigue. There's a lot of plot twists. There's a lot of stuff going on in this novel. But before I talk about that, you said that in Waco Tanks, you saw something that was an alignment of a shadow and figure. Can you be more specific on that?
Yes. The person who had the vision, her name is Martha. I won't use her last name.
Okay.
And she's the one that she's what you call psychic.
Mm-hmm.
And she has, from time to time, these visions. And she had a vision, and she said, the spirits at Waco Tank want us to find this cave.
Mm-hmm.
And there's these figures there at that cave. And so five of us went looking for it. One of those persons, the guide, was very familiar with Waco Tanks and assured us that there was no such cave or no such drawings. But after getting lost for several hours, we found it. We actually found it.
Oh, that's beautiful, because the getting lost itself is a wonderful symbol of submission to the experience.
It was part of the adventure, right. Yeah. And it is a cave, and there's a rock that forms a shadow, and underneath is a triangular figure. And the shadow aligns perfectly with that triangular figure twice a year, which means it...
You mean the way the sun comes in, and wow, this is like a scene from Indiana Jones.
Exactly.
This is exciting.
Exactly. And that point, that marker is actually occurs in astronomy. It's called analemma. It's an analemma point. As the sun moves between the tropics, it doesn't move back and forth in a straight line. It moves back and forth in a figure eight.
Oh, wow.
And there's a place, there's 2 days out of the year where, you know, coming from the tropics and then going back where they align perfectly. That's what forms a figure eight. And every region, you know, between, you know, between the path of the sun has a different analemma point, a different place where the...
Wow.
And it's over 1,000 years old, so the ancients who put it there were, you know, astronomers and marking an astronomical event.
So those authorities who said, no, you're in the wrong place, you're not going to find it, did you point it out to them, and did they change their mind after that point?
We have tried to get people interested in writing, you know, maybe a research paper or more research about it, but they acknowledge it. We took the entire El Paso Archaeological Society to that alignment,
uh-huh.
You know, and they all went and they saw the alignment. And so, there, you know, people, authorities are aware of it. They just haven't expressed much interest in it, which maybe that's the best. I don't know.
Right, right. You wouldn't want it to be like Epcot Waco tanks, right, with a bunch of people in line buying souvenirs. And
there are people here who host a yearly Sundance, mm-hmm. Sundance ceremony, and that group acknowledges the alignment and the sacredness of that alignment in that way.
Wow, that's fantastic. We're talking to Carlos Aceves, whose novel is called Diadema, and it's quite it's almost like a cross between, you know, the themes of Chicano indigenous literature and a mystery novel and even like a little detective novel kind of sprinkled in. It's incredibly compelling. Have you ever thought or have you ever seen this as a movie?
Well, I did community television for the community college for a long time.
Oh, wow.
And I have produced films, you know, short films.
Mm-hmm.
My first one was when I was still a student at UTEP. I did a couple of them, experimental films.
Nice.
And then at the community college, I actually produced also some. I have, for example, a little short called Mayan Time, based on the writings of Ernie Briones, who used to teach philosophy here at UTEP.
Uh-huh.
And so, yeah, whenever I write, I think in cinematic or television terms.
Would you ever consider turning this into a screenplay?
Well, of course. Of course.
Just haven't done it yet.
I just write it. I just barely finished writing the second novel.
No, nice.
So we'll see where I go with that.
Is that second novel related to this one?
It's related in a way, but it takes place between Canutillo and Las Cruces.
Mm.
That area is in itself mystical.
The safety corridor.
Yeah, and so I explore the mystical, mysterious aspects of that place, which, you know, many people perhaps aren't aware of it. But I include, like in Diadema, in this one, I actually include real people. And I asked their permission to include them. And so there's real people from the Las Cruces area in this novel. And it's about the end of the world.
You know, for those listeners who don't live in El Paso or don't know the region, because, you know, we have national audience, El Paso and Las Cruces are about 40 miles apart. And one of the most beautiful scenic drives, and I've been a lot of places like you have, one of the most beautiful scenic drives is actually driving from El Paso to Las Cruces on the side roads.
Yes.
And there is this incredible energy that the landscape kind of feeds you, you know. And even if you're not spiritually inclined or if you can't see beyond the veil, the fact is it just draws you to it. And I didn't know there was some sacredness about that region. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, I didn't put it in the novel that I just wrote because I don't want to talk too much about it. But the same marker, the same analemma marker that's at Waco Tanks is also in the Las Cruces area.
Mm.
It's in some university grounds where there's archaeological drawings, petroglyphs. And we found that same drawing, that same alignment over there is over here. That tells you about the sacredness of the area. But more specifically, the sacred mountain for that area of Las Cruces is called Tortugas Mountain.
Nice.
There's a several hundred-year-old festival that happens every year for the Virgen de Guadalupe.
Really? 700 years?
Well, not 700, but like over 300 years. It's over 300-year-old festival that happens there. And it's a village called Tortugas.
Tortugas,
used to be an indigenous, a totally indigenous village.
Let me ask you something about your fiction, and then I want to talk a little bit about Nine Seasons Beyond 2012, which I just think is a wonderful, almost like a primer or a guide or an anthology of
it's
Aztec
a self-help
wisdom.
Book. Yeah. Self-help book.
Self-help book. I like that. But let me ask you first about your approach to fiction. I have a lot of fiction writers here, and of course I teach MFA program. And for you, what is the most important part of your fiction? Is it the idea? Is it the character? Is it the plot? Is it the play of language? What is most important for you as a novelist when people get your work? What do you want them to be mostly attached to?
My work is based on actual events that are, believe it or not, occurrences.
Right.
Kind of like the X-Files.
Uh-huh.
And so I've often thought about writing that as nonfiction. But you lose credibility. People don't,
They start going, ah, that's not true.
That's right. And so I want the impact of the mystery of life, the sacredness of life, to come through to the reader's heart. And that you can only do through fiction.
Mm-hmm.
You can't do it through nonfiction.
Wow.
David Hall, who used to teach here, I took a course from him a long time ago. He said, if you want to change the world, don't write a book about facts. Write a story or a novel. Joseph Campbell says, myths are true, but they're not factual.
I'm talking to Carlos Aceves, author of Diadema, a novel, and then a self-help book called Nine Seasons Beyond 2012, A Manual of Ancient Aztec and Maya Wisdom. Carlos, you have been very involved in the local community here in El Paso. I would even say you're an activist. And you taught for many years as an elementary school teacher?
23 years.
Are you still teaching?
I just retired.
Wow, wow. And did you love to teach?
I love teaching young children. And I'm going to go back to it in a different way. I don't know how yet, but I will.
Right. And now that you're retired, other than writing, what are you doing?
Presentations, workshops on a lot of the themes that are in the book Nine Seasons.
Mm-hmm.
Nine Seasons is actually a personal journey. You know, some 35 years ago, I faced some very serious health challenges.
Mm-hmm.
I had respiratory allergies that used to make my nose bleed. I was suffering the consequences of having fallen off a moving vehicle when I was 4 years old.
Oh, my.
So half of my skull hurt, and I could never touch it because it would hurt. I couldn't bend down and touch my toes without my whole body shaking.
I can't do that now. I try, but I can't.
And I had arthritis. I had the beginnings of arthritis.
Mm-hmm.
I was diagnosed with diabetes, and I weighed 240 pounds.
You weigh 240 pounds?
I did.
Believe it. If you could see Carlos right now, you see a very slim, very healthy-looking man.
Yes. Now, because I've applied those teachings, because to me, if a philosophy isn't practical, you're just contemplating your navel and not doing much else.
Right.
So I've applied those principles to my own life, to my own health, and today I can say that I'm healthy. I have no medication. I'm not taking any kind of medication.
Not even for your diabetes.
Not even for diabetes.
Wow! May I ask how old you are?
My birthday is coming up 61.
Wow. Wow. And you look very healthy. Like you're going to be around for a while.
So Nine Seasons, the premise is human beings are engineered to last 104 years.
I thought it was 120 years according to the Torah, the Old Testament.
Well, every culture has its own,
And so in the Mayan culture, it's 104 years?
Mexican indigenous culture is 104.
Oh, wow. That's interesting.
Because 52 years is half of your life, and then the next 52 is
I can totally believe that. I think we are meant to last that long, at least.
Yeah, we just don't know how. In the Yellow Emperor's Book of Medicine, which is the basis for Chinese natural medicine, including acupuncture, mm-hmm. That was written, thousands of years ago. It says there were once a people who knew the way, and because they followed it, they were able to live over 100 years old.
Right. They were able to listen to their bodies. Nobody listens to their bodies anymore. In fact, if I were to eat something and I get heartburn and I'm miserable, I don't say maybe I shouldn't have eaten that. I say, what medication can I take?
Exactly.
And then it relieves that and allows me to eat like that more and more. But that's not listening to our bodies. We don't know how to do that. And so this is obviously what you've done. You've listened to your body. And what else do you listen to?
Well, you have to listen to the body. Nine Seasons is a guide how to listen to your body, how to listen to the earth, how to listen to the moon, how to listen to the stars.
Right.
and not only listen, but follow direction.
Right.
And that's what the book is about, is, you know, creation is made to be our teacher, our maestra.
If we listen to the moon and if we listen to the sun and we listen to the stars, in a sense, everything that we encounter on this earth in the natural world, whether it's a tree or a rock or cactus or a mountain, has not only its intrinsic value, but it also means something from above. It also has some sort of meaning.
We're all in this giant wave that resonates. It vibrates. We're mm-hmm. part of the same vibration.
String theory.
Well,
you know. String theory actually would corroborate what you're saying.
Well, quantum physics and particle physics corroborates a lot of what indigenous or ancient cultures practiced.
Right.
You know, Buddha said that we suffer because we're attached. In Mexican indigenous philosophy says we suffer because we don't know who we are.
And Schopenhauer says we suffer because we desire. If we desire too much.
That's because we don't know who we are. Yeah. If we knew who we are, we wouldn't have to desire.
Right, right.
We have everything.
You know, I love this book, Nine Seasons Beyond 2012. It's like a manual. In fact, you open it up and there's these different headings like nutrition, motion. And as I was reading the section on motion and exercise, you talk about the right way and the wrong way to climb up the stairs. And I was reminded of when I went to Teotihuacan several years ago. You know, one of the things that people do is they climb all the way to the top of Sol y Luna, right? And and I remember I was with a Mexican woman who lived in Mexico City. She was kind of showing me around, and she goes, watch. She goes, look at the way the gringos walk up the stairs. It's different from the way the Mexicans walk up the stairs.
And I
did, and she was right. The gringos were just straight up, whereas the Mexicans were walking in a zigzag.
Exactly.
And you explained that.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about that concept?
Well, it's very simple. You know, when you walk up stairs in a zigzag, it doesn't put a strain on your back.
Mm-hmm.
We were given legs, strong legs on which our weight should be. And yet, Western society, we put all our weight on our spine, the weakest part of our bodies.
Wow.
Go figure.
Yeah.
That's why we have so many back injuries.
Right.
There's simple concepts in there.
Do you think that the Mexicans who I witnessed zigzagging knew this instinctually, or is it something they're taught?
Originally, it was taught. It was learned and taught. But of course, in a culture, when something is learned and taught, after a while, you don't even have to formally teach it.
It becomes part of your
perspective. It becomes part of the culture.
Yeah, I remember thinking about when I used to work in a restaurant years ago. It was this really nice steakhouse in California. And as you know, in California, the Latino communities, at least in where I'm from, Fresno, were often very poor and still are. There was a lot of prejudice. There was a lot of oppression, you know, and I grew up in this area that was very, very racist. And now and then, I was the only Mexican that was a waiter. And I was the only man, too. It was all these blonde, beautiful women that I was working with. So sometimes when I went to a table of men and said, can I take your order, they were quite disappointed. But all the Mexicans, almost every one of them that came into the restaurant, I would say 95% of them ordered their steak well done. And the waitresses used to make fun of them. They used to say, oh, it's a Mexican, well done, because if you eat really good meat, to cook it well done is almost like, you know, putting ketchup on foie gras. Not that we would eat it. And I started to think, well, you know, it makes sense. I don't think that it's necessarily, I think it's kind of representative of how, coming from a poor background, you need to cook your meat because you're not getting the best meat. You're getting what you can afford, and you need to cook it. But generations later, even when you can afford good meat, you have acquired a taste to that.
Yeah, a custom becomes a habit.
Well, you know, thank you for joining us, Carlos. I love these two books. You got to check them out. You can get them on Amazon. Carlos Aceves, his novel Diadema, and Nine Seasons Beyond 2012. When's your next book coming out?
As soon as I find a publisher.
Well, I hope that soon. Thank you, Carlos, for joining us on Words on a Wire.
Thank you.
For poetic license today, I want to do something a bit different. Andres Montoya and I used to do readings up and down the state of California, especially activist-type readings. And we went to Sacramento one time, and he introduced me to this poet named Phil Goldvarg. And this guy was a short Jewish man, maybe in his 40s, perhaps in his 50s. And he was more Chicano than the rest of us. I mean, you just spend 5 minutes with this guy, and he was a Chicano, and you knew it. And his poetry was very Chicano, and he loved the Montoyas, and he loved the movement. And he died in 2004, and I remember I was in Buenos Aires when I heard about his death. And I remember sitting by a window writing a poem as if I were channeling his voice. But just recently, I did a reading in Sacramento, and somebody said, I brought up Phil Goldvarg, and somebody says, hey, I know him. And they gave me a CD with his poems on it. So I want to play in honor of activism, in honor of the Chicano movement, and in honor of the dead souls of Phil Goldvarg and Andres Montoya, a couple of poems from that CD. The first poem is called The Eagle Is Not Down, and the second one is just the way the CD closes. It has no title. So here he is, Phil Goldvarg, Bien Chicano.
The eagle is not down. He's in a different sky. Wings still moving against the currents of injustice. There is no death for this peaceful warrior. He looks down on us. His quiet fire eyes say, tú eres mi otro yo. You are me. I am you. Semos juntos. Aquí en el cielo y abajo en la tierra madre. Semos juntos en la tristeza de la noche, en la felicidad del día. The eagle is not down. He's in a different sky. Los chuecos, the greedy growers, the legislators who legislate los farm workers and their niños to death are shaking in fear. They know the eagle is not down and that there's going to be some serious huelgas in heaven and hell. ¿Sabes qué, hermano? Porque the eagle is not down. He's in a different sky. There is no death for this peaceful warrior.
And in the end, the word whispers, I bring you peace. Be still. Cállate.
That was Phil Goldvarg. Phil, wherever you are, thank you. Thank you for that poem, and thank you for your commitment to the Chicano movement. I'm Daniel Chacon. I'd like to thank my guest, Carlos Aceves. I'd like to thank you for joining us. And don't forget, the next book you read may save your life.
I'm up on the tight wire. One side's ice and one is fire. It's a circus game.